food were worth having, even if they had no idea who had actually died. Sajid Khan was there with his wife. I recognized her from the sliding photograph and greeted me as I came in. He was in an unusually cheerful mood, as if his former client had been filed away rather than buried, and a whole new business opportunity had begun. James Taylor was standing next to him and muttered just three words as I made my way past. "See you tonight." He clearly couldn't wait to leave. I found Charles, who was deep in conversation with the Reverend Tom Robeson. The vicar was much larger than he had appeared in the cemetery. He certainly towered over Charles and the other guests. Seeing him more closely and out of the rain, I was also struck by how unattractive he was. He had the dull eyes and the slightly misplaced features of a boxer who had been in too many fights. He had changed out of his robes. He was wearing a worn-out sports jacket with patches on the sleeves. As I approached, he was making a point, jabbing with a half-eaten sandwich. "But there are villages that simply won't survive. Families are being split up. It's morally unjustifiable." Charles glanced at me a little irritably as I joined them. "Where did you go?" he asked. "There was someone I knew." "You left very suddenly." "I know. I didn't want them to get away." He turned back to the vicar. "This is Tom Robeson. Susan Ryland. We were just talking about second homes," he added. "Southwold, Dunwich, Walmerswick, Orford, Shingle Street, all along the coast." Robeson had to make his point. I cut in. "I was interested in the address you made at the funeral," I said.
"Oh, yes?"
He looked at me blankly. "You knew Alan when you were young?"
"Yes. We met a long time ago."
A waiter went past with a tray, and I snatched a glass of white wine. It was warm and sluggish, a Pinot Grigio, I think. "You suggested that he bullied you." Even as I spoke the words, it didn't seem likely. Alan had never had much of a physical presence, and Robeson must have been twice his size when they were kids. He didn't deny it, though. Instead, he became flustered.
"I'm sure I said no such thing, Mrs. Ryland."
"You said he demanded a place in the cemetery."
"I'm sure that's not the word I would have used. Alan Conway showed exceptional generosity towards the church. He made no demands whatsoever. When he asked if he might one day be laid to rest in the cemetery, I felt it would be deeply ungrateful of me to refuse, even if, I will admit, I had to request a special dispensation."
The vicar was glancing over my shoulder, looking for a way out. If he had squeezed his hand any tighter, his glass of elderflower juice would have exploded.
"It's a great pleasure to meet you," he said. "And you, Mr. Clover. If you'll excuse me."
He slipped between us and waded into the crowd.
"What was all that about?" Charles asked. "And who was it you met when you went rushing off?"
The second question was easier to answer. "Mark Redmond," I said.
"The producer?"
"Yes. You know he was here the weekend Alan died."
"Why?"
"Alan wanted to talk to him about the television series, The Atticus Adventures. Redmond told me that Alan was giving him a hard time."
"I don't understand, Susan. Why exactly did you want to talk to him? And why were you so aggressive with the vicar just now? You were almost interrogating him. What exactly is going on?"
I had to tell him. I didn't know why I hadn't told him already. So I took him through the whole thing. My visit to Claire Jenkins, the suicide letter, the Ivy Club, all of it. Charles listened to me in silence, and I couldn't help but feel that the more I spoke, the more ridiculous I sounded. He didn't believe what I was saying, and listening to myself, I wasn't sure I believed it either. Certainly I had little or no evidence to support it. Mark Redmond had stayed a couple of nights in a hotel. Did that make him a suspect? A waiter had had his idea stolen. Would he have travelled all the way to Suffolk to get revenge? The fact remained that Alan Conway had been terminally ill. At the end of the day, why kill someone who was going to die anyway? I finished. Charles shook his head.
"A murder writer murdered, he said. Are you really serious about this, Susan?
Yes, Charles, I said. I think I am.
Have you told anyone else? Have you been to the police?
Why do you ask?
Oh, for two reasons. I don't want to see you make a fool of yourself, and frankly, I think you could be stirring up more trouble for the company.
Charles, I began, but then came the sound of a fork being struck against the side of a glass, and the room fell silent. I looked round. James Taylor was standing on the staircase that led up to the bedrooms, with Sadiq Khan next to him. He was at least 10 years younger than anyone else in the room, and couldn't have looked more out of place.
"Ladies and gentlemen," he began, "Sajid has asked me to say a few words, and I'd like to start by thanking him for making all the arrangements today. As most of you know, I was Alan's partner until very recently, and I want to say that I was very fond of him and I will miss him very much. Quite a lot of you have been asking what I plan to do next, so I might as well tell you that now he's gone, I won't be staying in Framlingham, although I've always been very happy here. In fact, if anyone's interested, Abbey Grange is about to go on the market. Anyway, I want to thank you all for coming. I'm afraid I've never much liked funerals, but as I say, I'm glad to have had this chance to see you all and to say goodbye. And goodbye to Alan especially. I know it meant a lot to him, being buried in the cemetery at St. Michael, and I'm sure lots of people will come here and visit him, people who liked his books. Please have some more to eat and drink, and thank you again. It wasn't much of a speech, and it had been delivered not just awkwardly, but a little carelessly too. James had already told me that he couldn't wait to get out of Suffolk, and he had made it clear to everyone else too. While he was speaking, I had glanced around the room, trying to gauge the different reactions. The vicar was standing to one side, stony-faced. A woman had joined him, much shorter than him, plump, with sprawling ginger hair. I presumed she was his wife. John White hadn't come to the reception, but Detective Superintendent Locke was there, if indeed he was the black man I had identified at the cemetery. Melissa Conway and her son had left the moment James had started speaking. I saw them slip away through the back door, and I could understand how they must have felt, listening to Alan's boyfriend. It was still annoying, though, as I'd wanted to talk to them, but I couldn't dash off a second time. James shook hands with the solicitor and left the room, stopping briefly to mutter a few words to one or two well-wishers. I turned back to Charles, expecting to pick up on our conversation, but at that moment his mobile pinged. He took it out and glanced at the screen. "My car's here," he said. He had arranged a taxi to take him to Ipswich Station. "You should have let me drive you," I said. "No, it's all right." He reached for his coat and draped it over his arm. "Susan, we really need to talk about Alan. If you're going to go on with this inquiry of yours, obviously I can't stop you. But you should think what you're doing. The implications."
"I know."
"Are you any closer to finding the missing chapters? If you want my honest opinion, that's much more important."
"I'm still looking."
"Well, good luck. I'll see you on Monday." We didn't kiss each other goodbye. I have never kissed Charles, not once, in all the years I've known him. He's too formal for that, too straight-laced. I can't actually even imagine him kissing his wife. He left. I threw back the rest of my wine and went to fetch my key. I planned to have a bath and a rest before my dinner with James Taylor, but as I made my way back towards the stairs, the other guests were dispersing now, leaving trays of uneaten sandwiches behind. I found my way blocked by Claire Jenkins. She was holding a brown A4 envelope, which must have contained at least a dozen sheets of paper from the look of it. For a moment, my heart leapt. She had found the missing pages. Could it really be as easy as that? It wasn't. "I said I'd write something about Alan," she reminded me, waving the envelope uncertainly in front of her. "You asked what he was like as a boy, how we grew up together.
Her eyes were still red and weepy. If there was a website that sold exclusive funeral wear, she must have found it. She was wearing velvet and lace, slightly Victorian, and very black.
"That's very kind of you, Mrs. Jenkins," I said.
"It made me think about Alan, and I enjoyed writing it. I'm not sure it's any good. I couldn't write the way he did, but it may tell you what you want to know."
She weighed the envelope one last time, as if reluctant to part with it, then pushed it towards me.
"I've made a copy, so you don't need to worry about sending it back. Thank you."
She was still standing there, as if expecting something more.
"I'm so sorry for your loss."
"Yes, that was it." She nodded.
"I can't believe he's gone," she said.
And then she went herself.
My brother, Alan Conway. I can't believe Alan is dead. I want to write about him, but I don't know where to start. I've read some of Alan's obituaries in the newspapers, and they don't even come close. Oh, yes, they know where he was born, what books he wrote, what prizes he won. They've said some very nice things about him. But they haven't managed to capture Alan at all. And I'm frankly surprised that not one of those journalists telephoned me, because I could have given them a much better idea of the sort of man he was, starting with the fact, as I told you, that he would never have killed himself. If Alan was one thing, it was a survivor. We both were. He and I were always close, even if we did disagree from time to time. And if his illness really had driven him to despair, I know he would have called me before he did anything foolish. He did not jump off that tower. He was pushed. How can I be so sure? You need to understand where we had come from, how far we had both travelled. He would never have left me on my own, not without warning me first. Let me go right back to the beginning. Alan and I were brought up in a place called Chorley Hall, just outside the Hertfordshire town of St. Albans. Chorley Hall was a preparatory school for boys, and our father, Elias Conway, was the headmaster. Our mother also worked at the school. She had a full-time job as the headmaster's wife, dealing with parents and helping the matron when the children fell sick, although she often complained that she was never actually paid. It was a horrible place. My father was a horrible man. They were well suited. He had come to the school as a maths teacher, and as far as I know, he had always worked in the private sector, perhaps because back then they weren't too fussy about the sort of people they employed. That may sound a terrible thing to say about your own father, but it's the truth. I'm glad I wasn't taught there. I went to a day school for girls in St. Albans, but Alan was stuck with it. The school looked like one of those haunted houses you get in a Victorian novel, perhaps something by Wilkie Collins. Although it was only 30 minutes from St. Albans, it was at the end of a long private drive, surrounded by woodland, and felt as if it was in the middle of nowhere. It was a long, institutional sort of building, with narrow corridors, stone floors, and walls half covered in dark-coloured tiles. Every room had huge radiators, but they were never turned on, because it was part of the school's ethos that biting cold, hard beds, and disgusting food are character-forming. There were a few modern additions. The science block had been added at the end of the 50s, and the school had raised money to build a new gymnasium, which also doubled as a theatre and an assembly hall. Everything was brown or grey. There was hardly any colour at all. Even in the summer, the trees kept out a lot of the sunshine, and the water in the school's swimming pool, it was a brackish green, never rose above 50 degrees. It was a boarding school with 160 boys aged from 8 to 13. They were housed in dormitories with between 6 and 12 beds. I used to walk through them sometimes, and I can still remember that strange, musty and slightly acrid smell of so many little boys. Children were allowed to bring a rug and a teddy bear from home, but otherwise they had few personal possessions. The school uniform was quite nasty. Grey shorts and very dark red V-neck jerseys. Each bed had a cupboard beside it, and if they didn't hang their clothes up properly, they would be taken out and caned. Alan wasn't in a dormitory. He and I lived with our parents in a sort of flat that was folded into the school, spread over the second and third floor. Our bedrooms were next to each other, and I remember that we used to tap out coded messages to each other on the dividing wall. I always liked hearing the first knocks coming, quick and slow, just after Mother had turned out the lights, even though I didn't ever really know what he meant. Life was very difficult for Alan. Perhaps our father wanted it to be. By day he was part of the school, treated exactly the same as the other boys. But he wasn't exactly a boarder because at night he was at home with us. The result of this was that he never fitted into either world. And of course, being the son of the headmaster, he was a target from the day he arrived. He had very few friends, and as a result, he became solitary and introspective. He loved reading. I can still see him, age 9, in short trousers, sitting with a large volume of something in his lap. He was a very small boy, so the books, particularly the old-fashioned ones, often looked curiously oversized. He would read whenever he could, often late into the night, using a torch hidden under the covers. We were both afraid of our father. He was not what you would call a physically powerful man. He was old before his time, with curly hair that had gone white and which had thinned out to allow his skull to show through. He wore glasses, but there was something about his manner that transformed him into something quite monstrous, at least to his children. He had the angry, almost fanatical eyes of someone who knew they were always right. And when he was making a point, he had a habit of jabbing a single finger in your face, as if daring you to disagree. That was something we never did. He could be viciously sarcastic, putting you in your place with a sneer and a whole tirade of insults that searched out your weaker points and hammered them home. I won't tell you how many times he humiliated me and made me feel bad about myself. But what he did to Alan was worse. Nothing Alan ever did was right. Alan was stupid. Alan was slow. Alan would never amount to anything. Even his reading was childish. Why didn't he like playing rugby or football or going out camping with the cadets? It's true that Alan was not physically active as a child. He was quite plump, and perhaps a bit girlish, with blue eyes and long fair hair. During the day, he was bullied by some of the other boys. At night, he was bullied by his own father. And here's something else that may shock you. Elias beat the boys in the school until they bled. Well, there was nothing unusual about that, not in a British prep school in the 70s. But he beat Alan, too, many times. If Alan was late for class, or if he hadn't done his homework, or if he was rude to another teacher, he would be marched down to the headmaster's study. It never happened in our private flat. And at the end of it, he would have to say, "Thank you, sir." Not, "Thank you, father," you notice. How could any man do that to his son? My mother never complained. Maybe she was scared of him herself, or maybe she thought he was right. We were a very English family, locked together with our emotions kept firmly out of sight. I wish I could tell you what motivated him, why he was so unpleasant. I once asked Alan why he had never written about his childhood, although I have a feeling that the school in Night Comes Calling owes a lot to Chorley Hall. It even has a similar name. The headmaster who gets killed is also similar in some ways to our father. Alan told me he had no interest in writing an autobiography, which is a shame, because I would have been interested to see what he made of his own life. What can I tell you about Alan during this time? He was a quiet boy. He had few friends. He read a lot. He didn't enjoy sport. I think he was already living very much in the world of his imagination, although he didn't begin writing until later. He loved inventing games. During the school holidays, when the two of us were together, we would become spies, soldiers, explorers, detectives. We would scurry through the school grounds, searching for ghosts one day, for buried treasure the next. He was always so full of energy. He never let anything get him down. I say he wasn't writing yet, but even when he was 12 and 13 years old, he loved playing with words. He invented codes. He worked out quite complicated anagrams. He made up crosswords. For my 11th birthday, he made me a crossword that had my name in it, my friends, and everything I did as clues. It was brilliant. Sometimes he would leave out a book for me with little dots underneath some of the letters. If you put them together, they would spell out a secret message. Or he would send me acrostics. He would write a note, which would look ordinary if mother or father picked it up. But if you took the first letter of every sentence, once again, it would spell out a message that would be known just to the two of us. He liked acronyms, too. He often called mother Madam, which actually stood for Mum and Dad Are Mad. And he'd refer to father as Chief, which meant Chorley Hall is extremely foul. You may think all this a bit childish, but we were only children. And anyway, it made me laugh. Because of the way we were brought up, we both got used to being secretive. We were afraid of saying anything, expressing any opinion that might get us into trouble. Alan invented all sorts of ways of expressing things so that only he and I understood. He used language as a place for us to hide. Chorley Hall came to an end for both of us in different ways. Alan left when he was 13, and then, a couple of years later, my father suffered a massive stroke that left him semi-paralyzed. That was the end of his power over us. Alan had moved to St. Albans School, and he was much happier there. He had an English teacher he liked, a man called Stephen Pound. I once asked Alan if this was the inspiration for Atticus Punt, but he laughed at me and said that the two weren't connected. Anyway, it was clear that, one way or another, his career was going to be in books. He had started writing short stories and poetry. When he was in sixth form, he wrote the school play. From this time on, I saw less and less of him, and I suppose in many ways we grew apart. When we were together, we were close, but we were beginning to live our own separate lives. When we got to university age, Alan went to Leeds, and I didn't go to university at all. My parents were against it. I got a job in St. Albans, working in the records department of the police force, and that's how I ended up marrying a police officer, and eventually coming to live and work in Ipswich. My father died when I was 28. By the end, he was bedridden and needed round-the-clock support, and I'm sure my mother was grateful when he finally conked out. He had taken out a life insurance policy, so she was able to support herself. She's still alive, although I haven't seen her for ages. She moved back to Dartmouth, where she was born. But back to Alan. He studied English literature at Leeds University, and after that he moved to London and went into advertising, something a lot of young graduates were doing at the time, particularly if they had a degree in humanities. He worked at an agency called Alan Brady and Marsh, and as far as I can tell, he had a wonderful time, not working very hard, getting paid quite well, and going to a lot of parties. This was the 80s, and advertising was still a very self-indulgent industry. Alan worked as a copywriter, and actually came up with quite a famous line, "What a lovely-looking sausage." It's another one of his acrostics. It spells out the name of the brand. He rented a flat in Notting Hill, and for what it's worth, he had plenty of girlfriends. Alan stayed in advertising throughout his 20s, but in 1995, the year before he turned 30, he surprised me by announcing that he had left the agency and enrolled in a 2-year postgraduate course in creative writing at the University of East Anglia. He had invited me down to London, especially to tell me. He took me to Kettner's and ordered champagne, and it all came spilling out of him. Kazuo Ishiguro and Ian McEwan had both gone to East Anglia. They had both been published. McEwan had been shortlisted for the Booker Prize, and Ishiguro had won it. Alan had applied, and although he didn't think he would be accepted, this was what had happened. There had been a written application, a portfolio of writing, and then a tough interview with two faculty members. I had never seen him happier or more animated. It was as if he had found himself, and it was only then that I realized how much being an author mattered to him. He told me he would have 2 years to write a novel of 80,000 words under supervision, and that the university had strong links with publishers, which might help him get a deal. He already had an idea for a novel. He wanted to write about the space race, seen from the British perspective. "The world is getting smaller and smaller," he said, "and at the same time, we are getting smaller within it." That was what he wanted to explore. The main character would be a British astronaut who never actually left the ground. It was called Look to the Stars. We had a lovely weekend, and I was very sad to leave him and go back on the train to Ipswich. There's not much I can say about the next couple of years, because I hardly saw him at all, although we talked on the telephone. He loved the course. He wasn't too sure about some of the other students. I'll be honest and say there was a prickly side to Alan, which I hadn't noticed before, but which seemed to be growing. Maybe it was because he was working so hard. He clashed with one or two of the tutors who criticized his work. The funny thing is that he had gone to UEA for guidance, but now that he was there, he had come to believe he didn't need it. "I'll show them, Claire," he used to say to me. I heard it all the time. "I'll show them." Well, Look to the Stars never got published, and I'm not sure what became of it. In the end, it was over 100,000 words long. Alan showed me the first two chapters, and I'm glad he didn't ask me to read the rest, because I didn't like them very much. The writing was very clever. He still had this wonderful ability to use language, to twist words and phrases the way he wanted, but I'm afraid I didn't understand what he was going on about. It was like every page was shouting at me. At the same time, I knew I wasn't the audience for the book. What did I know? I liked reading James Herriot and Danielle Steele. Of course, I made the right noises. I said it was very interesting, and I was sure publishers would like it. But then the rejection letters started coming in, and Alan was terribly disheartened. He was just so sure that the book was brilliant. And you have to ask yourself, if you're a writer sitting alone in a room, how can you keep going otherwise? It must be awful having that total self-belief, only to find that you've been wrong all the time. Anyway, that was how it was for him in the autumn of 1997. He'd sent Look to the Stars to about a dozen literary agents and a whole lot of publishers, and nobody was showing any interest. It was even worse for him because two of the students on the course with him had actually got deals. But the thing is, he didn't give up. That wasn't in his nature. He told me he wasn't going back to advertising. He was afraid that he wouldn't continue with his real work. That was what he called it now, because he'd be too distracted and he wouldn't have the time. And the next thing I knew, he'd got a job as a teacher, teaching English literature at Woodbridge School. He was never particularly happy there, and the children must have sensed it, because I got the impression that he wasn't very popular either. On the other hand, he had long holidays, weekends, plenty of time to write, and that was all that mattered to him. He wrote another four novels. At least, those were the ones he mentioned to me. None of them were published, and I'm not sure Alan would have been able to continue at Woodbridge if he had known that it would be 11 years before he finally got a taste of success. He once said to me that it was like being in one of those Russian prisons where they lock you up without telling you the length of your sentence. Alan got married while he was at Woodbridge. Melissa Brooke, as she was then, taught foreign languages, French and German, and started the same term as him. I don't need to describe her to you. You've met her often enough. My first impressions were that she was young, attractive, and that she was very fond of Alan. I don't know why, but I'm afraid the two of us didn't get on very well. She barely even acknowledged me at Alan's funeral, but I have to admit that it may have been partly my fault. I felt we were in competition, that she had taken Alan away from me. Writing this now, I can see how stupid that is, but I'm trying to give you as honest account as I can of Alan and me, and that's how it was. Melissa had read all his novels. She believed in him 100%. They were married at the register office in Woodbridge in June 1998 and had their honeymoon in the south of France, in Cap Ferrat. Their son, Freddie, was born 2 years later. It was Melissa who advised Alan to write the first Atticus Punt novel. By this time, they had been married 7 years. I know that's a giant leap forward, but there's nothing else I can write about in this period of time. I was working for Suffolk Constabulary. Alan was teaching. We weren't living far apart geographically, but we had completely different lives. Melissa had her light bulb moment in the Woodbridge branch of W.H. Smith. Who were the best-selling authors on the shelves? They were Dan Brown, John Grisham, Michael Crichton, James Patterson, Clive Cussler. She knew Alan could write better than any of them. The problem was that he was aiming too high. Why bother writing a book which all the critics rave about, but which hardly anyone reads? He could use his talents to write something quite simple. A whodunit. If it sold, it would launch his career, and later on he could try other things. What was important was to get started. That was what she said. Alan showed me Atticus Punt Investigates not long after he'd written it, and I absolutely loved it. It wasn't just the cleverness of the mystery. I thought the main character of the detective was brilliant. The fact that he'd been in a concentration camp and seen so much death, and here he was in England solving murders. It just seemed so right. It had only taken him 3 months to write the book. He had done most of it during the summer holidays, but I could tell that he was pleased with the result. The first question he asked me was if I'd guessed the ending, and he was delighted when I told him I'd been completely wrong. I don't need to add much more, because you know the rest as well as me. The manuscript found its way to Cloverleaf Books, and you bought it. Alan went down to your offices in London, and that night we all had dinner together, Alan, Melissa, and me. Melissa cooked. Freddie was asleep upstairs. It was meant to be a celebration, but Alan was in a strange mood. He was apprehensive, subdued. There was something between him and Melissa, a tension that I couldn't quite understand. I think Alan was nervous. When you've been pursuing an ambition all your life, it's actually quite frightening to achieve it, because where will you go next? And there was something else. Suddenly, Alan saw that the world is full of first novels, that every week dozens of new books fall onto the shelves, and not many of them make any impact. For every famous writer, there must be 50 who simply disappear, and it was quite possible that Atticus Punt might not just be the realization of a dream, it might be the end of it. Of course that didn't happen. Atticus Punt Investigates was published in September 2007. I loved seeing the first copy, when it arrived, with Alan's name on the front cover and his photograph on the back. Somehow it made everything feel all right, as if our whole lives had been leading to this one moment. The book got a wonderful review in the Daily Mail. "Watch out, Poirot. There's a smart new foreigner in town, and he's stepping into your shoes." By Christmas, Atticus Punt was appearing in the bestseller lists. There were more good reviews. They even talked about Atticus on the Today program. When the paperback came out the following spring, it seemed that the whole country wanted to buy a copy. Cloverleaf Books asked Alan to write 3 more, and although he never told me how much he was paid, I know it was a fantastic amount. He was suddenly a famous writer. His book was translated into lots of different languages, and he was invited to all the literary festivals, Edinburgh, Oxford, Cheltenham, Hay-on-Wye, Harrogate. When the second book came out, he did a signing in Woodbridge, and the queue stretched all the way round the corner. He left Woodbridge School, although Melissa continued working there, and bought a house in Orford, looking out over the river. It was just at this time that Greg, my husband, died, and Alan suggested I move closer to him. He helped me buy the house in Daphne Road that you visited. The books kept on selling. The money was pouring in. Alan asked me to help him with the third book, Atticus Punt Takes the Case.
He'd always been a terrible typist. He always did his first drafts in pen and ink, and he'd asked me to type up the first draft on the computer. Then he would make his revisions by hand, and I would type them up again before he sent the manuscript to his publisher. He also asked me to help him with the research. I introduced him to one of the detectives in Ipswich and dug out information about poisons and things like that. I actually worked on 4 of the books. I loved being involved, and I was sorry when that came to an end. It was completely my fault. Alan changed as a result of his success. It was as if he was overwhelmed by it. If he wasn't writing the books, he was traveling all over the world promoting them. I used to read about him in the newspapers. Sometimes I would hear him on Radio 4. But at this stage, I was seeing him less and less. And then, in 2009, just a few weeks after Night Comes Calling was published, Alan shocked me by telling me that he was leaving Melissa. And I couldn't believe it when I read that he had moved in with a young man. It's very difficult to explain how I felt, because there was such a whirl of emotions in my head, and so much that I didn't know. Living in Orford, I saw Melissa all the time, but I had absolutely no idea that the marriage wasn't working. They always seemed so comfortable together. It all happened very quickly. No sooner had Alan told me the news than Melissa and Freddie had moved out, and their home was on the market. There were no lawyers involved in the divorce. They agreed to split everything 50-50. Speaking personally, I found it quite hard to come to terms with this new side of him. I've never had a problem with homosexual men. There was a man I worked with who was openly gay, and I got on with him perfectly well. But this was my brother, someone I had been close to all my life, and suddenly I was being asked to look at him in a completely different light. Well, you might say he had changed in many ways. He was 50 now, a rich and successful author. He was more reclusive, harder-edged, the father of a child, a public figure. And he was gay. Why should this last fact have any special significance? Well, part of the answer was that his partner was so very young. I had nothing against James Taylor. In fact, I liked him. I never thought of him as a gold digger or anything like that. Although I will admit that I was horrified when Alan mentioned that he had once worked as a rent boy. I was just uneasy seeing the two of them together, sometimes holding hands or whatever. I never said anything. These days you're not allowed to, are you? I just felt uncomfortable. That's all. That wasn't the reason we fell out, though. I was doing an awful lot of work for Alan. Somehow it hadn't ended with the books. I was helping him with his fan mail. Some weeks he was getting more than a dozen letters, and although he had a standard reply, someone still had to do the administration. I worked on some of his tax returns, in particular the double tax forms that had to be filled in so he didn't pay tax twice. He often sent me out to get stationery or new printer cartridges for him. I looked after Freddie. In short, I was working as a secretary, an office manager, an accountant, and a nanny, as well as holding down a full-time job in Ipswich. I didn't mind doing any of this, but one day I suggested he ought to put me on his payroll, partly as a joke. Alan was furious. It was the only time he was ever really angry with me. He reminded me that he had helped me buy my house, although he had made it clear at the time that it was a loan rather than a gift. He said he thought I had been glad to help, and that if it was a chore, he would never have asked in the first place. I backed down as fast as I could, but the damage had been done. Alan didn't ask me to do anything for him again, and a short time later, he moved out of Orford altogether when he bought Abbey Grange. He never told me he was ill. You have no idea how much that upsets me. But I will finish where I began. Alan was a fighter all his life. Sometimes this could make him seem difficult and aggressive, but I don't think he was either of those things. He simply knew what he wanted, and he never allowed anything to get in his way. Above all, he was a writer. His writing meant everything to him. Do you really believe he would finish a novel and kill himself before he saw it published. It's unthinkable. It's just not the Alan Conway I knew.
St. Michael's.
It seemed to me that Claire had arrived at her conclusion for all the wrong reasons. She was right to believe Alan had not committed suicide, but the way she had got there was confused. I know he would have called me before he did anything foolish. That's where she begins. That's her main justification. By the end, though, she's trying another tack. Do you really believe he would finish a novel and kill himself before he saw it published? They're two quite different arguments, and we can deal with them separately. Alan was never one to forget a grudge. The two of them fell out badly when Claire asked to be paid for the work she was doing, and, despite what she thought, I don't believe they were ever really that close again. For example, although he told her that he was leaving Melissa, it's clear that she knew nothing about his relationship with James Taylor. He left her to read about that in the newspapers. It may be that when Alan came out as a gay man, he had left his old life behind him, like a discarded suit, and sadly, that included Claire. If he wasn't prepared to share his sexuality with her, why should he have shared his suicide? She also makes the mistake of thinking that the leap from the tower was something he had planned. He would never have left me on my own, not without warning me first. But that's not necessarily the case. He could have just woken up and decided to do it. He might have completely forgotten that he had a book coming out. He would have been dead before it was published anyway. What did it matter to him? Her account was interesting in other ways. I hadn't realized, even now, how much of his private life Alan had woven into Magpie Murders. Did he know before he was diagnosed that this would be his final novel? "We were pirates, treasure hunters, soldiers, spies," Robert Blakiston tells Atticus Punt. But he's also talking about Alan's childhood. Alan liked codes. Tom rapped out codes on his bedroom wall. And then there are the anagrams and the acrostics. Robeson becomes Osborne. Clarissa Pye solves an anagram in the Daily Telegraph crossword. Could Alan have hidden some sort of secret message inside his book? Something that he knew about someone? What message could it be? For that matter, if he knew something horrible enough to get himself killed, why play around? Why not just come straight out with it? Or could it be that the message was actually concealed in the final chapters? Had someone stolen them for that reason, killing Alan at the same time? That made some sort of sense, although it would beg the question of who, if anyone, had read them. There was still a couple of hours until dinner, and I decided to walk up to the Castle Inn. I needed to clear my head. It was already getting dark, and Framlingham had a forlorn quality. The shops closed, the streets empty. As I passed the church, I saw a movement, a shadowy figure moving between the tombstones. It was the vicar. I watched him disappear into the church, the door booming shut behind him, and on an impulse, I decided to follow. My steps took me past Alan's grave, and it was horrible to think of him lying beneath that freshly dug earth. I had thought him cold and silent when I had met him. He was eternally so in death. I hurried forward and entered the church. The interior was huge, cluttered, drafty, a collage of different centuries. It was probably unhappy to have arrived at this one. The 12th century had provided the arches, the 16th the lovely wooden ceiling, the 18th the altar, and what had the 21st bestowed upon St. Michael? Atheism and indifference. Robeson was at the back of the pews, quite close to the door. He was on his knees, and for a brief moment I assumed he was praying. Then I saw that he was attending to an old radiator, bleeding it. He turned a key, and there was a hiss of stale air, followed by a rattle as the pipes began to fill. He turned as I approached, and half remembered me, getting unsteadily to his feet. "Good evening, Mrs. Susan Ryland," I reminded him. "Miss,
I was the one who asked you about Alan.
A lot of people have been asking me about Alan today.
I asked if he bullied you.
He remembered that and looked away. I think I told you what you wanted to know.
Were you aware that he had put you in his latest book?
That surprised him.
He ran a hand over the slab that was his chin.
What do you mean?
There's a vicar in it who looks like you. He even has a similar name.
Does he mention the church?
St. Michael's? No.
Well, that's all right then.
I waited for him to continue.
It would be quite typical of Alan to say something unpleasant about me. He had that sort of sense of humour, if you can call it that.
You didn't like him very much.
Why are you asking me these questions, Miss Ryland? What exactly is your interest?
Didn't I tell you? I was his editor at Cloverleaf Books.
I see. I'm afraid I never read any of his novels. I've never been very interested in whodunits and mysteries. I prefer non-fiction.
When did you meet Alan Conway?
He didn't want to answer, but he could see I wasn't going to stop. Actually, we were at school together.
You were at Chorley Hall?
Yes. I came to Framlingham a few years ago, and I was quite surprised to see him in my congregation. Not that he came to church very often. The two of us were exactly the same age.
And?
There was a silence.
You said he had a dominant personality. Did he bully you?
Robeson sighed. I'm not sure it's quite appropriate to be discussing these things, today of all days. But if you must know, the circumstances were quite unusual, in that his father was the headmaster at the school. That gave him a certain power. He could say things, do things. He knew that none of us would dare to say a word against him.
What sort of things?
Well, I suppose you could say that they were practical jokes. I'm sure that's how he viewed them. But they could also be quite hurtful and malicious. In my case, certainly, he caused me a certain amount of upset. Although it's all water under the bridge now. It was a very long time ago.
What did he do?
Robeson was still reluctant, so I pressed him.
It's very important, Mr. Robeson. I believe Alan's death wasn't quite as straightforward as it seems, and anything you can tell me about him in confidence would be very helpful.
It was a prank, Miss Ryland. Nothing more. He waited for me to go away, and when I didn't, he added, he took photographs.
Photographs? They were horrible photographs.
It wasn't the vicar who had spoken.
The words had come from nowhere. That's the thing about church acoustics. They lend themselves to surprise appearances. I looked round, and there was the ginger-haired woman I had seen at the hotel, presumably his wife, striding towards us, her shoes rapping out a determined rhythm on the stone floor. She stopped next to him, gazing at me with undisguised hostility.
"Tom really doesn't want to talk about it," she said. "I don't understand why you're bothering him. We buried Alan Conway today, and as far as I'm concerned, that's an end to it. We're not going to engage in any further tittle-tattle. Did you fix the radiators?"
She had asked this last question in exactly the same tone without stopping for breath.
"Yes, dear."
"Then let's go home."
She put her arm in his, and although her head barely came up to his shoulder, it was she who propelled him out of the church. The door banged shut behind them, and I was left wondering exactly what the photographs had shown. And at the same time, whether it had been photographs that Mary Blakiston had found on the kitchen table in the vicarage at Saxby-on-Avon, and if perhaps they had been responsible for her death.
Dinner at the Crown. I didn't mean to get drunk with James Taylor, and I still can't remember how it happened. It's true that he was quite distracted when he arrived, and promptly ordered a bottle of the most expensive champagne on the menu, followed by a good wine and several whiskies. But I'd intended to leave the drinking to him. I'm not sure how much I learned in the next 2 hours,
I was certainly no closer to learning who might have killed Alan Conway or why, and when I woke up the following morning, I was fairly close to death myself. "God, I hate this fucking place." Those were his opening words as he slumped down at the table. He had changed into the same black leather jacket he had been wearing when I first met him, and a white T-shirt. Very James Dean. "I'm sorry, Susan," he went on, "but I couldn't wait for the funeral to end. That vicar didn't have anything good to say about Alan, and that voice of his. I mean, gravelly is one thing, but he could have been digging the grave himself. I didn't even want to be there, but Mr. Khan insisted, and he's been helping me, so I felt I owed him. Of course, everyone knows by now." I looked at him, questioning. "The money. I get the house, the land, the cash, the book rights, the lot. Well, he left quite a bit to Freddie, that's his son, and he looked after his sister, too. There's a bequest to the church. Robeson made him pay that in return for the plot. One or two other things. But I've got more money than I've ever had in my life. Dinner's on me, by the way, or on Alan. Did you find the missing pages of the manuscript?" I told him that I hadn't. "That's a shame. I've been rummaging around for you, but no luck. It's funny to think that you'll be dealing with me from now on, about the books, I mean. I've already had someone called Mark Redmond on the phone about the Atticus adventures. He's welcome to them, as long as I don't have to watch the bloody thing." He glanced at the menu, made an instant decision, and slid it aside. "They all hate me, you know. Of course they have to pretend. Everyone's too nervous to come out with it. But you can still see the way most of them were looking at me. I'm Alan's bum boy, and now I've got the lot. That's what they were thinking." The champagne arrived, and he waited while the waitress poured two glasses. I couldn't help smiling. He had just become a millionaire, and he was complaining about it. But he was doing it in a light-hearted, even a humorous way. It was a deliberate self-parody. He drained his glass in one go. "I'm putting Abbey Grange on the market first thing tomorrow," he said. "They'll probably hold that against me, too. But I can't wait to go. Mr. Khan says it could be worth a couple of £1 million, and I've already had interest from John White. Did I mention him to you? He's the hedge fund guy next door, super rich. He and Alan had this huge argument a short while ago, something to do with investments. After that, the two of them weren't even speaking. It's funny, isn't it? You buy a house in the middle of the countryside with about 50 acres, and the one person you don't get on with is your neighbor. Anyway, he might buy me out to get the extra land." "Where will you go?" I asked. "I'll buy a place in London. That's what I always wanted. I'm going to try and kick-start my career. I want to get back into acting. If they make the Atticus adventures, they might even offer me a part. That would be a turn-up for the books, wouldn't it? They could cast me as James Fraser, so I'd end up playing a character based on me in the first place. Do you know why he was called Fraser, by the way?"
"No, I don't."
"Alan named him after Hugh Fraser, the actor who played Poirot's sidekick on TV. And the flat that Atticus Punt lived in, Tanner Court in Farringdon, that was another of Alan's jokes. There's a real place called Florin Court, which they used in the Poirot filming. Do you get it? Tanner, Florin? They're both old coins."
"How do you know?"
"He told me. And he used to do other things, too. He used to hide things."
"What do you mean?"
"Well, names. One of the books is set in London, and all the names are actually tube stations or something like that. And there's another one where the characters are called Brooke, Waters, Forster, Wilde."
"They're all writers."
"They're all gay writers. It was a game he played to stop himself getting bored." We drank more champagne and ordered fish and chips. The restaurant was on the far side of the hotel, tucked around the corner from where the funeral drinks had taken place. There were a couple of families eating, but we'd been given a corner table. The lighting was low. I asked James about the way Alan Conway had worked. He had hidden almost as much as he had revealed in his writing, and there was an odd disconnect between the best-selling author and the books he had actually produced. Why all these games, these codes and secret references? Wasn't it enough simply to tell the story?
"He never talked to me about it," James said. "He worked incredibly hard,
sometimes 7 or 8 hours a day. There was a notebook he filled up with clues and red herrings, all that stuff. Who was where and when, what they were doing. He said it gave him a headache, sorting everything out. And if I came into the room and disturbed him, he would really yell at me. There were times when he talked about Atticus Punt as if he was a real person, and I got the idea that they weren't the best of friends, if that doesn't sound a little bit weird. "Atticus is destroying me. I'm fed up with him. Why do I have to write another book about him?" He said that sort of thing all the time. Is that why he decided to kill him? I don't know. Does he die in the last book? I never saw any of it. He gets ill. He may die at the end. Alan always said there would be 9 books. He decided that from the very start. There was something about that number that was important to him. What happened to the notebook? I asked. I don't suppose you found it. James shook his head. I didn't find it. I'm sorry, but I'm pretty sure it's not there. So whoever had taken the last chapters of Magpie Murders, erasing every last word from Alan's hard drive, had also made sure that his notes had disappeared. That told me something. They knew how he worked. We talked more about James's life with Alan. We finished the champagne and drank the bottle of wine. The other families finished and left, and by 9 o'clock we had the room to ourselves. I got the impression that James was lonely. Why would a man in his end-twenties want to bury himself in a place like Framlingham? The truth was that he had had little choice. He'd been defined by his relationship with Alan, and that, if nothing else, must have been a reason to end it. James was very relaxed as he spoke to me. The two of us had become friends, maybe because of that first cigarette, maybe because of the strange circumstances that had brought us together. He told me about his early life. "I was brought up in Ventnor," he said, "on the Isle of Wight. I hated it there. At first, I thought it was because it was an island, because I was surrounded by the sea. But actually, it was because of who I was. My mum and dad were Jehovah's Witnesses, which I know sounds crazy, but it's the truth. Mum used to go round the island, distributing copies of the Watchtower door to door." He paused. "Do you know what her biggest tragedy was?" "She ran out of doors." The problem for James was not so much the religion or even the patriarchal structure of his family life. He had 2 older brothers. It was that homosexuality was considered a sin. "I knew what I was when I was 10 years old, and I lived in terror until I was 15, he said. "The worst of it was not having anyone I could tell. I'd never been close to my brothers. I think they knew I was different. And living on the Isle of Wight, I felt like I was growing up in the '50s. The place isn't so bad now, at least that's what I hear. There are gay bars in Newport and gay cruising areas all over the place. But when I was a kid, and with the elders coming to the house and all the rest of it, I felt completely alone. And then I met another boy at my school, and we began to mess around with each other. And that was when I knew I had to get out. Because if I stayed, I would end up being caught with my pants down, quite literally. And then I'd be shunned, which is what Jehovah's Witnesses do to each other when they're pissed off. By the time I got to my GCSEs, I decided I wanted to become an actor. I left school at 16 and managed to get a job at the Shankling Theatre, working backstage. But 2 years later, I left the island and came up to London. I think my family was quite glad to see me go. I've never been back. James couldn't afford drama school, but got his training elsewhere. He met a man in a bar and was introduced to a producer who used him in a number of films that would not enjoy a premiere on mainstream British television. I'm the one being coy. He was frank and filthy about his career in hardcore porn, and as the second bottle of wine kicked in, we both found ourselves laughing uproariously. He was also working as a rent boy in London and Amsterdam. "I didn't mind doing it," he said. "A few of my clients were pervy and disgusting, but most of them were fine, middle-aged men who were absolutely terrified of being found out. I had plenty of regulars, I can tell you. I enjoyed the sex and the money, and I made sure I looked after myself." James had managed to rent a small flat in West Kensington, and he worked out of there. One of his clients was a casting director, and he even managed to get him a few legitimate parts.
And then he met Alan Conway. Alan was a typical client. He was married. He had a young son. He had found my picture and contact details on the